Proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings. Hello, Boulder and Denver. Hello, America. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Boulder Theater. AM 760, Progressive Talk, our affiliate here in Boulder. Very pleased to be here, and it's great. We're going to be taking some questions from the audience and comments. Also, if our listeners all across the country want to call in, our number is 866-303-2270. We're going to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. I only have one PC up here at the moment, so I'm not in the chat room, so I want to call out and say hi to the folks in the chat room. And apologize that I can't hang out in there today, but there's just too much going on one little screen. The big news today, the story in the Washington Post, and it's coming out more and more ever since James Comey's testimony Tuesday, that increasingly it's looking like something really, really nasty was going on in the White House that had to do with spying on Americans. And with the FBI participating with Ashcroft and Andy Card, the FBI following Ashcroft and Andy Card down to the hospital where Gonzalez and Andy Card, down to the hospital where Ashcroft was sick with pancreatitis, to try and get him to sign off on a program that he refused to sign off on. I mean, he's laying, he's so sick he can hardly move. He lifts up his head and says, "No, I won't do it." And Comey had refused to do it, and that's why these guys were doing it, and why Gonzalez and Card were trying to get him to sign off on it. Now, what is it that he was signing off on? I mean, there's all these layers to this thing, and who said what, and who did what, and how does this tie into the U.S. attorney scandal and Gonzo Gate and all this stuff? I think, when you boil it all down, this is increasingly, as I believe it was Pat Leahy said yesterday before the Senate, this is increasingly starting to look like a Watergate kind of operation. This is increasingly starting to, tragically, impeach, right? This is increasingly, one of the things, probably the thing that Richard Nixon did that was most offensive to the people of the United States. I mean, there were specific crimes that he was impeachable for that were listed in the bill of impeachment, in the articles, the three articles of impeachment that were tendered against him back in the 70s. But it took the consensus of the American people. It took the American people figuring out that something terrible was going on to really get the momentum going, to really get people cranked up and saying, yeah, this is worth doing something about. This is wrong. This is absolutely wrong. And that critical mass is something that has to be reached here in the United States as well. And to a certain extent, hitting that critical mass is going to require a relatively simple storyline. It's going to have to be something that can be encapsulized in a sentence or two, and in order for most Americans to get it, in order for it to be that soundbite. I mean, it's like the Republicans in the 90s doing the, well, Clinton lied, and all that kind of thing, or Clinton was immoral or whatever. They boiled these things down to a couple of soundbites. And frankly, it seems to me that the administration, and certainly the Republicans in Congress, the support group for this thing, are doing everything they can to try and make this as complex as possible, and the press isn't helping particularly all that much. But what we're seeing now is that, first of all, it looked like, and this was the article by Eric Lichtblau and his associate way back in 2003 that first exposed the NSA spying program. The NSA is the super secret spy agency. It's got many times the budget. In my recollection, is 10 times, might have been 100 times. I think it's 10 times the budget of the CIA. They're responsible for all the satellites, all the electronic intercepts. They coordinate intelligence between nations. They do all kinds of stuff, most of which is the kind of stuff that we would absolutely, I'd say probably the vast majority of it, the kind of stuff that we would absolutely want being done in a world where it is important to know what's going on around you and it's useful stuff. And there was a law put in place back 25, 30 years ago after the Nixon abuses, where Nixon was created his enemies list. I mean, this is what people remember, was his enemies list, that he was wiretapping people, that he was using the FBI and the CIA to illegally wiretap people, and that he was using the IRS to hassle them, you know, to audit their tax returns and go after people. That's the kind of stuff that the public gets. It could happen to you. It could happen to me. It certainly was happening to Democratic politicians, and it was happening to writers for newspapers. And so initially, the first story was, oh, it's the NSA, and it has to do with people with Arabic-sounding names or Muslim-sounding names, you know, odd, you know, unusual, somewhere in the Middle East talking to somebody who's probably has a similar name. You know, it's Ahmed in the Middle East talking to Ahmed in New York City, and we need to know what's going on. And, you know, there's probably a general consensus that if these two Ahmeds are somehow involved with Al-Qaeda, that we do want to know what's going on. And that's what the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court was put into place for in the first place. You know, and it gives the administration pretty much carte blanche to listen in on telephone calls. They have up to 3 days to go back and say, hey, you know, we'd like approval for this after the fact. Thousands, tens of thousands of these things were issued. And it involves people who are not foreign citizens, and where one of them is in the United States and the other is outside the United States. So first of all, the New York Times broke this story saying essentially that they were spying on U.S. citizens. Well, hey, if there's U.S. citizens involved in terrorism, we want to know about that. And B, that the administration was trying to go around the court. Now, why would they go around the court? I think it's important that we keep in mind, and this is something that hasn't been brought up, but we need to keep coming back to, is that back in the first couple of years of the Bush administration, I think it was 2002, it was discovered that the Republicans in the Senate, operating out of Orrin Hatch's office, as I recall, there was a fellow in Orrin Hatch's office who had succeeded in hacking into Ted Kennedy's personal computer, not personal, but his Senate office computer, along with a half a dozen other Democrats. And these were the Democrats who were, in particular, Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And as they were putting forward federal judges, as they were contemplating putting forward the nominations of Supreme Court justices, they wanted to know what the Democrats' strategy was going to be. And so they were essentially wiretapping the Democrats' computer and reading all this email. And this has come out. I mean, this is not a secret. The American people have, by and large, forgotten it. The media never really did a particularly good job reporting on it. The guy who was responsible for it in Orrin Hatch's office ultimately left, and I believe he was fired, and Orrin Hatch issued an apology saying, oh, gee, I didn't know what was going on, except that somehow all the Republican strategists, you know, the Karl Rove bunch, they all knew what was going on. They knew what the Democratic strategies were. They were preempting the Democratic strategies. They were going out to the press the day before the Democrats would roll out some great new phrase that they, or the Democrats had identified some weakness with a judicial candidate, and the Republicans would be out there on all the talk shows going, you know, heading it off at the pass, so that when the Democrats came out, they had already been pre-refuted. So we know that this is, I don't even want to say an administration, we know that this is a party. You know, I keep saying, I think that maybe we should be looking at using the RICO laws against the Republican Party, or at least some members in it, rather than just this administration. George Bush is not up for re-election. This is not about George Bush. Although, you know, Richard Nixon arguably wasn't up for re-election either, and in fact, he wasn't. It became emblematic, you know, it became symbolic. Nixon became symbolic of the rot that was going on throughout the Republican Party, and I think that rot has revisited itself. So, for example, there's a lot of speculation going on right now, and this is the sort of thing that has not yet made its way into the mainstream press, although there is, you know, some questioning of it. This article in today's Washington Post, for example, that is up at the top of Huffington Post right now. For example, over at tpmmuckraker.com, which is a great blog, and Paul, they're quoting this story, The President's Secret Program, A Timeline, and by Paul Kyle. And increasingly what we're discovering is that starting back in 2003, it wasn't just about looking in on terrorists. It might, in fact, big parts of it may have had nothing to do with looking in on terrorists. It may have had to do with checking out political opponents. It may have been as simple as checking out Democrats. We don't know. It may have been, you know, a little more complex, like Nixon had the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover was out looking at Quakers and, you know, the anti-war groups and the Unitarians, and it could have been that. The bottom line is, we don't know. We don't know. And whether it's purely political or not, I mean, a lot of that's going to come out of what we hear from Karl Rove, from the emails from Karl Rove and that sort of thing. And now the Justice Department, today it's reported, it probably came out yesterday afternoon, Justice Department's saying they don't know where Karl Rove's emails are. They don't have access to them. Probably they're with Karl Rove's attorney. And so, yeah, baloney, exactly. And so we're going to see how this thing tracks down. So I just, you know, who was the president wiretapping? Who was he tracking down? Why and when? And these are some pretty important questions we need to get some answers to pretty quick. 16 minutes past the hour. We're live from Denver, AM 760 Progressive Talk.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Oh, an enormous amount going on. Al Gore says he hasn't ruled out running for president. I think there's a lot of us who would love to see the guy who actually was elected president of the United States serve as president of the United States. It would be a fine thing. So we'll see how that one plays out. Valerie Plame, the lawsuit, she and Joe Wilson have filed a civil lawsuit against Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney and you know, a quarter of them suggested for termination between February 2005 and December 2006, according to sources familiar in documents withheld from the public. Oh, gee, nice. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified last week that the effort was limited to 8 U.S. attorneys. So now, okay, Gonzo lied to us, right? And, you know, Kyle Sampson. So there's stuff coming down the road here. And I want to know, frankly, the other question that it just astounds me is not being asked by the mainstream media, seemingly at all under any circumstances. The main question that's not being asked by the mainstream media is, what are the attorneys who are still in their jobs doing that doesn't get them on the list? Because if the things that got people on this list was things like prosecuting Republicans and investigating public corruption and actually looking into election fraud rather than voter fraud, you know, rather than tracking down Ann Coulter, I mean, you know, geez. And by the way, it turns out she was, you know, one of those folks who apparently committed election fraud. That's where an individual votes in the wrong place. She had her real estate broker's name written down as her address of residence for voting. That apparently somebody from the FBI called and said, let's put the kibosh on this thing. And so she was cleared, but now maybe not cleared, and now the FBI is looking into how she got cleared on it. But I mean, come on, Ann Coulter. I you know, there's no doubt in my mind that she She should have a right to vote. And this is not the kind of stuff, I mean, even as much as I despise Ann Coulter, this is not the kind of stuff that federal attorneys should be pursuing. You know, we have 38 cases now, about half of them have been thrown out in the last 6 years, where they found somebody who voted, you know, after having committed a felony in a state where that was illegal, or who registered twice, typically by accident, or who registered like Ann Coulter did at the wrong address. But what this does is by hyping this whole idea that there are individuals out there, this, you know, pointing the finger at individuals. There are individuals out there, conspiracies of individuals, to commit voter fraud. It allows the Republicans to divert the attention away. This is a classic magic trick. You know, if you're gonna pull a rabbit out of your hat with your right hand and you want everybody looking at that, you don't want them to see your left hand, you know, flipping the switch that pops the rabbit in there or whatever. You do something, you wave a scarf around with your right hand so they're watching your right hand while your left hand is doing what you do. And this is what's happening. The left hand that they don't want us looking at is the actual election fraud, the theft of the election, the disenfranchising of millions and millions of voters across the United States. The spying on us, the building this apparatus. Frankly, this all, in my mind, this is all Politburo apparatus. This is Soviet state apparatus. This is clamping down on the people, reducing the ability of people to participate in the democratic process, reducing the ability of people to vote, going after those who want to vote, and at the same time, building a system, the Total Awareness Information Network, or the NSA and FBI spying system, building a system where people are afraid, where they're intimidated, where they're afraid to speak out, punishing journalists who dare speak out against, you know, against the administration or ask hard questions. Helen Thomas getting thrown to the back room, all that kind of stuff. It's like we're seeing the Soviet Union come back all over again. It's just incredible, and it's not a good thing. It's just not a healthy thing at all. And so we need some serious investigations of this, and I want to know, what's the connection between the firings of the U.S. attorneys, the planned firings of the U.S. attorneys, the keeping of the jobs of the U.S. attorneys, and Karl Rove? What's the connection between the spying on Americans and Karl Rove? What brings all this stuff together? What brings it together in a way that, frankly, is certainly an impeachable offense, but even beyond that, that shows that a party, an entire party that represents an ideology. I mean, you saw this the other night with the Republican debate, where it's, you know, no, I want to nuke them faster than you want to nuke them. No, I want to torture them faster than you want to. An ideology that is not only out of sync with Americans, with the vast majority of Americans, but also profoundly and deeply out of sync with American values, with the values that we hold high here in this country. And therefore, the only way that they can hold power is through fear and intimidation and election fraud. And it needs to be exposed. It needs to be opened up. We're going to be coming back with your phone calls and also questions from the audience here in Denver, Boulder. We're here broadcasting live from AM 760 Progressive Talk in Boulder, Colorado.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, live from the Boulder Theater here with AM 760 Progressive Talk. Tom Hartman with you. And George Bush apparently just blew it in a press conference. This is interesting. This is the very topic that we were talking about. Somebody in Washington, D.C.'s ears are burning because you'll recall the big story, the big testimony day before yesterday in Congress was about how for the illegal wiretapping program, it's going to have to be a quarter inch or eighth inch or whatever. Ah, there we go. Cool. Okay. I might even be able to play the audio for this thing here. Try to get this hooked up. Anyhow, the big dramatic testimony was that Bush was, or not Bush, the Card and Gonzalez were racing down to get John Ashcroft to authorize this illegal spying program, and Ashcroft wasn't going to do it, and Comey was trying to stop them. Because he was actually the acting attorney general at the time, because Ashcroft was sick. So he was the guy who was supposed to be in charge, and they were trying to go around him, and he was trying to stop them. And now it looked, and he testified that it was George Bush who was directing this operation. So this morning, if this audio is working, we're going to find out here in just a second. This the press conference here in, at the White House.
Yes, sir. There's been some very dramatic testimony before the Senate this week from one of your former top Justice Department officials who describes a scene that some senators called stunning about a time when the wireless or when the warrantless wiretap program was being reviewed. Sir, did you send your then chief of staff and White House counsel to the bedside of John Ashcroft while he was ill to get him to approve that program? And do you believe that kind of conduct from White House officials is appropriate?
That's a pretty straightforward question, right? Let's see how he weasels out of this one.
Kelly, there's a lot of speculation about what happened and what didn't happen. I'm not going to talk about it. It's a very sensitive program. I will tell you that, one, that the program is necessary to protect the American people, and it's still necessary.
Yep. Sorry about that. It's the vagaries of computers, but he says it's
necessary because there's still an enemy that wants to do us harm.
Yes. Be afraid. Be very afraid. That's so. Anyhow, we have some folks in the audience here who have questions. Sir, welcome.
Is it on?
Yeah, it'll be
on. My name is Strider, and I would like to give a plug to your book, Unequal Protection, which I consider this the most crucial single work ever written about how our country was taken over by the corporations.
Well, thank you, sir.
Unequal Protection, 002. And could you comment on the relevance of this overall corporate agenda to the rather extreme abrogation of all democratic principles that we are seeing today, and especially the threatened extermination of the free press?
Yeah, sure. The thing to keep in mind, and your question is really, you know, it brings everything to a fine point. It's the perfect question. A corporation is an abstraction. It's an entity that exists entirely at law. I mean, there are buildings that corporations have and employees that corporations have, but the actual corporation itself is an abstraction. It is a set of legal principles that give certain limitations of liability and danger and harm to certain people who are doing things. And as such, it is essentially amoral, or it has its own intrinsic morality. A corporation has as its, and in fact the Supreme Court has ruled that it must be this way. Its principal morality is it must make profit. Profit at all costs. And the prime directive of that, or a big piece of that, is internalize profits, externalize costs. So if for example, the auto industry, the collusion between the auto industry and the fossil fuel industry, producing millions of cancers every year as a result of air pollution, they're externalizing that cost. They're not paying for those cancers. We are. We the people are. And they're internalizing profits. They're making profits selling the cars and selling the fossil fuels. And so to the extent to which we come along and say, hey, we'd rather have, you know, cleaner energy, the corporations are like, yeah, why should we care? You know, they're morally neutral. Democratic institutions, on the other hand, being responsible to we the people, have a very specific morality, and that is doing what's appropriate and best for we the people. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, from the Declaration of Independence, the six things outlined in the preamble to the Constitution, the reasons for existence. So there's a very clear and definite and real morality that reflects the morality of fragile human beings, the fact that we will live a certain lifespan and we will die, that we have to have fresh air to breathe, clean water to drink, all those kinds of things. And essentially, the collision between these two moralities is what I write about in that book on equal protection. And up until the late 1800s, the essentially amoral corporations and some individuals were by and large held in check by democratic institutions protecting we the people, the fundamental morality. And now we've seen the scales flip in the other direction. We the people have far less power. There's no way that much of the legislation that goes through Congress would go through Congress if Congress was actually voting the way we wanted them to rather than the way corporations want them to. And we're certainly seeing this with this administration. And the remedy that I propose in that book is ending corporate personhood, ending the idea that corporations should have rights of humans. And there's a strong movement to do that across the United States, and I think it's an important one. Yes, sir.
Since you mentioned this one thing about voting the way what the people want them to vote, I think we should also pay attention I think might be the replacement now for Rahm Emanuel with his trade deal thing.
Yeah.
Most importantly, though, another name keeps coming up with Attorney Gate and, as you mentioned earlier today, the spying on the computers of the other Judiciary Committee members, Orrin Hatch.
Yeah.
Attorney Gate, Orrin Hatch, two people who are the main players in Attorney Gate are people who used to work for Orrin Hatch, and I think he may be as big as Karl Rove in this.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Many of Orrin Hatch's former aides are ending up now working for Karl Rove and ending up also being involved in these events. Yeah. Good point, Jeff. Thank you very much. And it's great to meet you, Jeff from Denver, who calls our program.
And welcome to Colorado.
Thank you. Great to have you here.
I have one comment and one question. Ann Coulter and, you know, Gonzalez, the Attorney General, if they had three more IQ points, they'd be carrots.
Well, you know, it's easy to say that. I think, though, that we say that at our own risk. These folks are quite smart. And many of them just have a very different vision of America. They would like a country that is far more in their minds safe and secure mostly for rich white folks, and freedom is not high on their agenda. What we would call freedom.
Well, one last thing is, I was listening to you a few months ago, I guess, and you mentioned all these investigations that were going on. And I wondered if you couldn't mention what's going on with each of them once in a while, so we don't just get on one thing in the House and the Senate and the FBI and all that stuff.
That's a good suggestion.
I'll
pass that along to David Poole, my producer, and suggest to him that we start keeping a running list of all the various investigations and things that are going on with the Senate and whatnot. We'll do a weekly update. That would be a great little, investigation segment update, as it were. Let's just pull in one caller here, and we'll alternate a little bit. But we've got a lot of folks here in town who want to talk also. But Larry in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom, and Colorado and the nation. I'd like to offer you a little cheer for Vice President Dick Cheney and President George Bush. I hope the rest of you will join in with this, that it would go impeachment, indictment, incarceration. Impeachment, indictment, incarceration.
All righty, we got it, Larry. Good one. A great mantra. All right. Yes, sir.
Hey, Christian from Boulder here. As a child of the 70s, I'm curious to know how you would correlate the Saturday Night Massacre with what's going on currently. Because I'm...
Yeah, that
I
was...
Did,
that was
I
the,
was young at that.
That was the parallel that... I guess it was Pat Leahy made yesterday or day before yesterday. And the Saturday Night Massacre was when, as I recall, and I haven't gone back and read my history at that time, I just remember living through it, but it's been
right.
A lot of years. Was when Nixon had replaced his attorney general a couple of times. John Mitchell had either been indicted or was on his way to being indicted, and as I recall, Ruckelshaus was brought in, and there was somebody else who was brought in, and then there was also the special prosecutor Cox, and basically, I know I'm wrong on all the details here, but the bottom line was Nixon just started firing people. He started firing people who were you know constitutionally required to be investigating him because they worked for him. It would be the equivalent of Alberto Gonzalez deciding that he was actually going to do his job as Attorney General and investigate crime within the executive branch, and Bush were to fire him. And I think this is one of the reasons why Bush is hanging on to him. I mean, all four of Gonzalez's main number two people have resigned. Everybody's getting out of the way. They don't want to be the next ones fired. They don't want to be the next ones indicted, or they see it coming and they're lawyering up. And I think the Bush is desperately hanging on to Gonzalez because, he and Gonzalez know where the dirt is buried on each other all the way back to Texas.
Your friends close and your enemies closer.
There you go. Yeah. And we just, don't know what the nature of that relationship is or where it's going to go or how it's going to go. But it's becoming increasingly obvious that Gonzalez was lying. And now here, this is such an important thing. This clip that I played a little earlier of Kelly Arena. From CNN asking Bush just directly, what's the deal here where these guys are trying to get into John Ashcroft's hospital room and these guys being Andy Card, the chief of staff, and Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney, the personal lawyer for the president.
Isn't it bizarre that Ashcroft is the voice of reason here?
Yeah, I know.
I don't, it blows me away.
It really is. It really is. And therefore, it should be all the more shocking to all of us and more interesting to the press. And I think that's one of the reasons why the press is taking it seriously. 45 minutes past the hour, live from Denver, Boulder's AM 760. Progressive.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman here with you, nine and a half minutes before the hour, broadcasting live from the Boulder Theater in Boulder, Colorado, AM 760, Progressive Talk. This is an editorial that was in the Texas Observer, which is the newspaper that Molly Ivins used to write for before she died, God bless her. And this is just from very recently. This is from January of this year. In Washington, the level of corruption, of double dealing, and outright plunder cries out for stiff prison sentences to be handed out like candy canes. While Abramoff was a start, the feds hustled him off to jail before the full scale of the scandal could truly be exposed. Nonetheless, the former lobbyist did point the way toward a solution for the Bush administration's corruption problem. In 2002, now this is where it gets really fascinating. In 2002, Abramoff allegedly helped convince the president to remove the U.S. attorney in Guam. It appears that a public corruption investigation by the federal prosecutor was making some Abramoff clients uncomfortable. And so we need to be going back and looking at that one as well. By the way, I checked out the Wikipedia entry for the Saturday Night Massacre, and there were a few folks in the audience here who had the details right at the tip of their fingers. Saturday Night Massacre is October 20th, 1973, and Nixon dismissed Archibald Cox. This led to the resignations of Attorney General Elliot Richardson and Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelshaus. And Nixon actually didn't fire Cox. He had his his Solicitor General fire Cox, and that was Robert Bork. So, and the result of all of this was ultimately Nixon's impeachment and also the Independent Counsel Act, which has now expired. So, the next question from the audience.
Yes, I just wanted to say how much I appreciate you coming to the Boulder.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Thanks. And I just wanted to make a brief comment. I am a teacher. I'm also a grandma age. And I've been very involved with the issue of electronic voting. And I'm making this comment because I feel that, it's important that citizens speak out about what has happened to them. Is like I've been involved with electronic voting. I did contact my representatives about this issue, and subsequently I was visited by the government agents. And in fact,
You're
I
kidding.
Even believe that I've been put on a list. And I guess, my question is, when are we going to do something about the Patriot Act?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you believe that you were visited because you've been outspoken as an activist against electronic voting
machines.
Yeah,
I've actually got the story here, but yes, I was visited by government agents.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And see, the quick answer, the short answer to your question is we're going to do something about the Patriot Act when we convince enough of our elected representatives that they need to do something about it, or they're going to face our wrath in November of 2008. And that means, that gets us back to calling your members of Congress, writing letters to your members of Congress. Emailing pretty much doesn't work anymore because everybody gets so much spam and they largely ignore it. But telephone calls are still the very most effective way. And we need to be pointing out that our freedoms, our liberties, are, and perhaps most important, like the caller yesterday when we were after we had the conversation with David Horowitz, the caller, who said, you know, let's not forget Patrick Henry's famous quote, give me liberty or give me death, that our ability, our freedom to live in a country free of fear of our own government at that. And I realize in that regard, I'm sounding like a 1960s conservative. You know, that was Barry Goldwater's mantra. But nonetheless, it's something that, frankly, I think people on both sides of the aisle, conservatives and liberals, Democrats and Republicans, we all should be hearkening back to the founders' notion that we the people control our government and we the people limit the power of our government. Our government should have limited power. And then the question that becomes, you know, what is the primary purpose of government? And that's where generally conservatives and liberals split, with conservatives wanting government to play its punitive role and liberals wanting government to play a supportive role. But that's a whole another discussion. But the short answer, when we get our elected officials involved. Next person in line here. Oh, over here. I'm sorry. There you go.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Judah.
So my concern is that a lot of people are feeling that they don't have the power to be able to do anything about the situation. We're really good at citing problems, but feeling that we have the power within ourselves to be able to do something about it seems to be lacking. So I'm wondering if you'd be willing to address that. As you know, I'm a believer that we're all interconnected globally and that we have the ability to change the world by changing ourselves. So maybe you could give some inspiration to help people really feel their power and really not just stand around and complain, but really get the gumption and do something about
these
problems.
And you might want to tell people the title of your book.
Oh, I'm Judah Fried. My book is called A Global Sense, and Tom Hartman was generous enough to write the foreword.
Yeah, so good question, Judah. And it's and thank you. Clearly, we want good people to be involved. I mean, we need people involved in the political process. We need people involved, active, you know, getting out there and showing up at the meetings, showing up at party meetings, showing up at you know, Democracy for America. I mean, you've heard this mantra so many times, and yet it never gets old, because it really is. Just voting is not enough. Even just calling once in a while is not enough. And certainly, you know, getting out in the streets is not enough. We have to actually become part of the political process, participate with the Green Party, participate with the Democratic Party, participate with the Republican Party, you know, all of these things, and become part of the process that becomes part of the change. I think if we don't do that, we're lost. And we have, you know, a generation. I mean, since Reagan basically, the main message of the Reagan years was, don't get involved with the political process. The corporations will take care of everything. Everything's going to be fine. We'll just leave it up to big business. And it was a disastrous message. We just have a half a minute here before we have to wrap up the hour. Quick question?
Oh, yeah, Tom. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I just started listening to you a few weeks ago, and you're one of the first people that made me start listening to talk radio again. I was listening to your comment about the late Jerry Farwell and how you didn't want to dig up into his negativity and how he bred polarization and hatred among people.
You
and
know,
so on, so
we're,
on.
The music is going to slam us here in just a second,
okay.
So let's hold on. Hold that thought right there, and we'll be back in the next hour. Tom Hartman broadcasting live from Boulder, Colorado, the Boulder Theater.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
So should we have laws against terrorism? Welcome back, by the way. Broadcasting live today from the Boulder Theater in Boulder, Colorado. AM 760 Progressive Talk. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from AM 760. And we have Peter Farah with us. He's on the line. He's with the anti-ACLU, the ACRU. Their website, thehecru.org, that is the American Civil Rights Union. And Peter is the general counsel. Peter, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Peter, you have written that this hate crimes bill, H.R. 1592, that has passed Congress, the Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2007, which does a few small things, but the large thing it does is it includes gay people under the umbrella of protection with regard to hate crimes. That it's a fine thing, in fact, a good thing, that George W. Bush intends to veto this. You want to give us your explanation for that?
Well, I mean, all crimes are hate crimes. So what sense does it make to have special, quote-unquote, hate crime designations for certain crimes based on politics and for some and not others? It violates equal protection under the law to say that some people are deserving of different protection by the criminal law, have super penalties applied to their crimes, whereas other people, well, you know, if you commit crimes against them, it's not a big deal, and you can be let off. It's a fundamental liberal principle, in fact, that we should have equal protection under the laws, and this seems to me to violate equal protection. There's another problem, too, which is that the word hate is a vague word. This is something that liberals should be concerned about as well. I mean, you may call something, what exactly is hate? One person's hate may be another person's fundamental religious.
Well, this
doctrine
is one of the reasons why we have juries. But let me ask a hypothetical question then. Let's say for a moment that we were able to demonstrate in a court of law beyond any shadow of a doubt that Osama bin Laden or Sheikh Khalid, whatever his name is, or, you know, whoever, a person. Let's say it's Osama bin Laden. We've got him in custody, and we can demonstrate that he was responsible for what happened on 9/11. You're suggesting that he should only be charged with the murder of 3,000 people, that there should be no additional charges, that there should not be, the terrorism should not be a crime.
Well, murder is a crime. You don't need another definition for it. But see, the part of the problem here is that the more conservative side of the argument, they want severe penalties for violent crimes. But on the liberal side, that's a dubious proposition. For example, you had the case of the racist in Texas who dragged a black man to his death behind their pickup truck. And the liberals in Texas wanted a hate crime law to commemorate that.
Well, no, it's not about commemorating. It's about saying that when you try to commit acts of terrorism, when you try to terrorize an entire group of people simply because of who they are, that in and of itself is a crime in addition to the crime that you committed that was the terroristic act in the first place.
Here's the point you're missing. Conservatives like me are in favor of the death penalty for a crime like that. So what is to be gained by, in addition to saying, oh, well, we're going to have an additional crime called a hate crime? You can only execute them once.
Let's take the example, for example, of the guys, of an attempt to blow up the World Trade Center that's unsuccessful. Nobody dies. There's not a death penalty for that, but it has successfully terrorized New York City. Or what if, you know, somebody was to release some sort of radioactive agent? You don't immediately know that anybody's died, but probably over time, you're going to have a couple hundred thousand cases of cancer. Some kind of dirty bomb goes off in a suitcase. Nobody's near enough to die. You don't have an immediate death penalty case. You don't think that they should be charged with terrorism?
Well, you know, do you have the death penalty for these hate crimes? You know, in cases where the death penalty doesn't otherwise apply?
I mean, it depends on the state.
It depends
on the state. This is federal legislation.
Look at the federal legislation. Does any of these hate crimes, does any state hate crime have a death penalty associated with it? Well, we wouldn't have had imposed the death penalty in this case. But because of the hate crime, now you get the death penalty? No, that's not the law in any state. And there's no case where, you know, the conservatives are in favor of severe punishments for all these violent crimes. So there's nothing to be gained by trying to invent the notion of a quote-unquote hate crime.
You know, this is a straw man argument. We're talking with Peter Ferry. He's the general counsel to the American Civil Rights Union. TheACRU.org is their website. It to suggest that, first of all, that if violent crimes are committed, that somehow conservatives think that people should be punished differently than liberals think they should be punished is nonsense.
Well, that's what I think. That's my opinion. My opinion is that the conservatives are in favor of much harsher penalties for violent crimes than liberals are, which is why the concept of a hate crime doesn't make much sense to a conservative who already wants harsh penalties for violent crimes and attempts at violent crimes and all of those things. So there's really nothing to be gained by it. And how do you divide people up and say, well, if you commit a crime against these people, we're going to call it a hate crime?
Because what we're doing is we're identifying specific groups of people who have historically been the victims of terrorism, of domestic terrorism, whether they be African Americans, whether they be gays. We're identifying specific groups of people who have historically been the victims of terrorism and saying when you commit a crime that's not just a crime, you're not just stealing this guy's car, you're not just sticking somebody up, it's not just a crime. You're doing it in a way that's intended to intimidate an entire class of people. That in and of itself is an additional crime.
How can you miss that? He only committed one crime. He only committed one crime.
No, you committed two crimes.
Now listen for a minute. You can take into account the total damage and harm caused by the crime in a penalty phase. you can take into account the total damage and the total harm caused. So that if they go up and beat up senior citizens because they hate all senior citizens, and then they create a climate of fear among senior citizens, that can be taken into account in the sentencing phase. But see, you look at the impact, then it's a neutral application. It's not this political special interest group application, this liberal special interest group application, where you're saying this is when the politics enters into it, this is what people object to. They don't want the criminal law defined in terms of political special interest groups.
So
they
what you're suggesting then is that the conservative position is that there should be no protections to any groups of people, that if anybody wants to engage in acts of terrorism against somebody because of who they are, in addition to committing a crime, that, you know, that's fine.
That's fine? What does that mean, that's fine?
That's fine. They're only going to be...
That's fine? What does that fine mean? That makes no sense at all.
They are only going to be charged with the basic crime.
Well, let me explain the conservative position. If you engage in acts of terrorism against people because who they are, you get the death penalty.
Do you think that we should have terrorism laws in the United States? Bush, you know, there are all these conservatives running around. In fact, you had Republican presidential candidates climbing over each other a couple nights ago, trying to be hard, you know, tougher and tougher on terrorism. You have the Patriot Act reinvented. You have the Military Commissions Act. You have the John Warner Military Appropriations Act. All of these that provide brand new punishments for acts of terrorism. That is where people who are, you know, by and large foreign and by and large members of a religion which is not the predominant religion in this country try to terrorize our entire nation. You want that to be a category of crime, but if it happens to be somebody that you don't particularly like in this country who's being terrorized, you don't think that that should be a crime.
You know, this shows the vague thinking of liberals. You know, when you say terrorism, another vague word, you got to look at concrete crimes.
So you think there should be no laws against terrorism?
Murder, assault, blowing somebody up. Those are the things you get prosecuted for. You don't get prosecuted for some vague thing like hate. Well, you hate people, Mr. Farwell, because you call
hate. Hate crimes do not prosecute people for hate. They prosecute people for behavior.
You're metamorphosizing into the conservative right in the middle of this debate. Yes, you prosecute them.
It is a behavior which is terroristic behavior.
You prosecute them for the harm they cause by those behaviors. And you define
Peter, you haven't answered my question.
Neutral terms. You define the penalty on neutral terms, not on politicized terms.
So in other words, you think that we should roll back the Patriot Act. We should do away with the Military Commissions Act. All these things should be done away with because they have the word terrorism in them. There shouldn't be special laws that have to do with people who are committing acts that are intended to terrorize
people. Exactly what in the Patriot Act is defined in terms of terrorism?
Well, frankly, I don't have the law.
But you
understand the principle that I'm talking about.
Yeah, but it's not in the law. See, they don't use the word the way you're using it. They don't say, you know, we were going to have special rights to investigate because of quote unquote terrorism. They define specific.
It is the entire political rationale of George Bush saying that he doesn't even have to have warrants because he's going to protect us from the terrorists.
A political rationale is one thing, but the law is something else. And I don't want to put in either these vague politicalized terms
there are laws against terrorism. In fact, for example, up in Oregon, there have been groups that have been prosecuted or attempted to be prosecuted for interrupting commerce as a way of terrorizing people.
And interrupting commerce?
That's right. They're using it against the deep ecology movement.
But all these cases, you have to have something specific done. You don't have this quote-unquote terrorism, and you prosecute them for some specific crime that they did where they violated somebody's rights.
But you want the legislation to be just fine when it's against a group that is on your side and terrible if it's against blacks or if it's against gays.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. But I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have the
a silly notion if we want them to be friends. They prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Okay, this is an article from the New Standard. It's a newspaper. Let's see if, you know, very often you get these newspapers that are, this is just the first thing that came up on Google, you know, that's a local town newspaper, but it's Washington, D.C., by Megan Tandy. Dateline, November 15th, 2006. Monday afternoon, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that reclassifies unlawful animal rights tactics as terrorism under certain conditions, even if they are nonviolent. As reported by the New Standard, just hours before the House took its voice vote in the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, EATA, the bill will classify civil disobedience actions such as blockades, property destruction, trespassing, and the freeing of captive animals as terrorism. The AETA amends current law, enabling the government to prosecute activists for intentionally damaging private property used by animal enterprises, businesses that use or sell animals. The AETA expands those provisions to enhance penalties against activists who, quote, interfere, end quote, with animal enterprises by destroying property or engaging in behavior that, quote, appears threatening, end quote. It even includes perceived threats to companies that work with animal enterprises and takes into account resulting profit losses. So, anyhow, that was the point I was trying to make, and I didn't have the specific law in front of me. But kudos to Peter Ferreira from the American Civil Rights Union, theacru.org, for coming on and mixing it up with us. I always appreciate it when folks are willing to do that. And it's amazing. You would be amazed how many conservatives are absolutely unwilling to come on this program. And just, you know, no, ain't going to happen. Not going to have that conversation. So Rich in Los Angeles, California, welcome to the program. Hey, Rich.
Hi, Tom. You know, the hypocrisy is that the Republicans would sign the bill for hate crimes if sexual orientation was left out of it. And I always look at it with the, that it's not, well, I like your take that it's terrorism against a group. I've always thought about it as that to have a separate law because the people that do these crimes don't think it's against the law to drag a black guy from the behind a car until his head comes off. They don't think it's against the law to take a lead pipe and bash a gay man or person they even perceive as being gay, bash their head in. And it's you know, so maybe a separate law would have people thinking, oh yeah, it is against the law.
Yeah.
And
these but people. I think it goes beyond that, Rich. It's not. Yeah, I mean, they, you know, clearly people know that murder is against the law, but what we're trying to say is that if crimes are committed, and crimes short of death penalty crimes, if crimes are committed with the intention of terrorizing an entire group of people who have a history of being terrorized in the United States, that we're going to make that a crime. And that just seems like a reasonable position to be.
Well, I didn't think that so these people actually thought that it was against the law to do this, that because the like the Harvey Milk defense where the guy gets off, you know, because he had Twinkies, you know.
Yeah,
They seem to think that there's lesser of a crime because of who you're going against.
Exactly, and that's a great example of where it would have been a good idea to have a hate crime in place. Rich, thanks a lot for the call. Michael in the Bronx, New York, listening to WWRL. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just
you know,
good.
I was listening to your debate on hate crimes, and I think I have an excellent definition. Mm-hmm. For one thing, with the hate crime, you have to have a certain motive, and that motive is the intention of violating the person and inflicting pain, be it physical, mental, or both, and for the sole purpose of the offender's bias against that person.
Well, see, we already have laws that say that against a person. The point of a hate crime is that it is a crime that is committed against a person, but the real intended victim is not the person, it is the group, the category, the class of people.
But see, the reason why I had put that into play is because it makes you wonder why when you have police officers that engage in racial profiling and police brutality, for example, they are not charged with the hate crime. There should be an element of hate crime because why are they targeting blacks? Why are they targeting gays? because of their prejudice against them. And if it's because of departmental policy.
Yeah. Well, that's it's really a whole separate issue, Michael, but you raise a good and important point, and a lot of police departments around the country are really struggling with that. Mike in Scottsdale, Arizona, about a minute before we've got to take a break here, Mike.
Hi, Tom. The gentleman from the ACRU makes the cardinal error of assuming that crimes are penalized because of the outcome. And that's not the case in our Jewish prison system. The crime, the intent matters entirely. Look at murder, first degree, second degree, and third degree murder. They're not the same thing, even though the outcome is the same.
Even though the person is still dead. Right.
Right.
Yeah. If you hit somebody with your car by accident, it's one kind of crime. And a fairly minor one. If you hit somebody with your car by accident, but you're drunk, it's a whole different kind of crime, and they die. Or if you see somebody driving down the street or walking down the street, and you don't like them, and you intentionally run them down, it's a third kind of crime. In all cases, a car hit a person, the person died. It's three completely different crimes. Good point. And we have a long history in this country of saying that the intent behind a crime has something to do with the crime. And as I said, with hate crime legislation, it really should be renamed terrorism legislation. We just need to start calling it that. And it surprises me, frankly, that the legislators who are doing this didn't figure this out a long time ago. Maybe it's because up until 2001, terrorism wasn't that big a deal for us here in the United States. We didn't have politicians hyping it constantly. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Broadcasting live from the Boulder Theater, AM 760 Progressive Talk in Boulder, Denver. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. All kinds of wild stuff going on in the news. It's Gonzo Gate getting wilder and weirder by the day as things go on. We've got a number of callers we'll be getting to, and also folks here in the audience who have some questions. First, I want to answer a question that we had a little meet and greet before the event and met a few folks, and several people asked me questions about my cat, Higgins, apparently. So I just thought I'd just very quickly tell that story that our son was at college at the University of Georgia 5 years ago. There was this dorm down the street from him, or this fraternity house, and these guys had this kitten that they were keeping locked up in a room with a pit bull. And whenever the kitten misbehaved, they'd throw it against the wall, and they locked it in the bathroom for days at a time. And Justin felt that the kitten was being badly abused. The kitten had reached the point where it was so aggressive that nobody could get near it, which is why they locked it in the bathroom. And so he took it away from them and then came to us and said, "Will you take this cat?" And so we took Higgins in, and the first 6 months that we had him, whenever we walked into the room that we kept him in, we had to wear clothing that covered our arms and our legs and leather gloves because he would come after us. And to this day, whenever the shower is on, he goes running in because that was his only source of nutrients, was the dripping shower in the bathroom that he was locked in. So Higgins is kind of wounded by his kittenhood experience. But 3 years ago or so, several of our cats got some kind of really nasty virus, and Higgins was really sick. I mean, we took him to the vet. The vet actually even did some surgery on him, thought he had an obstructed bowel or something, and it wasn't that. And he was unable to even lift his head. He was so sick. And I picked up his head, and I looked into his eyes, and I said, "Higgins, I love you, and I'm going to be here for you, and you're going to be better, and we're going to see this through." And it's really weird because Louise, we have four cats, and Louise feeds the cats. And those of you who have cats or dogs, we've had dogs all our life too. Our last dog Sabra died at the age of 18 about 4 years ago, and now we live in a houseboat, and so it's just not so easy for a dog. But you all know that the person who feeds the animal is the person that the animal likes, right? I mean, that's the But Higgins, Louise is okay, but. Whenever I walk in the house, he's right there. He follows me around like a dog. If I'm laying down, he wants to sit on my chest. If I'm working, he wants to sit on my shoulders. And if anybody comes into the house, he becomes the pit bull, and he's going to defend us. And so just you know, it, several people asked about it this morning, and so I thought I'd just tell that story. Welcome to the program. Some of our folks here, we're broadcasting live from the Boulder Theater here in Boulder, Colorado, and a huge audience. The theater is full, and we have a microphone here and some people who want to ask questions. And so one gentleman was in the middle of a question before our last break, and we were talking about Jerry Falwell. And so if you'd like to come back, and let's pick that up. Okay,
hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I was listening to you yesterday about Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, and your comments, you said you didn't want to get into his negativity, you know, and his polarization of people and his dividing people. Obviously, you know, as far as I'm concerned, he actually probably caused some harm. But then you got into some story about yourself where you had some realization sitting with an old man, sitting in a card table or something like that in the backyard of a farm, and other people have had similar realizations when they were young. And I don't know why you brought it up, but then you said you wouldn't be surprised if Jerry Falwell probably had a similar realization when he was very young, but as he got older and corrupted, just blew it like many of us did. Personally, I think he got on the wrong bus and got on off the wrong stop myself.
Okay. Yeah.
But I don't know why you were compassionate to him. I mean, to me, he was like good riddance.
Yeah, well, I was pretty, I think, clear and explicit in saying, and will repeat, that I think that Jerry Falwell has, by and large, been a net force, negative force in this country, a force for harm in this country. And I think that just stands as his record. But I do think that somebody at a young age deciding to go into the ministry, there are a few people who go into it because they view it as a power trip for the same reason that some people go into police departments or into politics or whatever. But I think that I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt and that he was looking for something that obviously he never found, because there was so much hate in this guy's heart in the last few years. You see him on TV speaking with hatred. Clearly, if he had gotten close to it, he lost it. And I just thought it was poignant and sad, frankly. And there were a lot of my peers who were using it, and just in general, people taking the opportunity of Falwell's death to either praise him or condemn him. And I felt that there was a bigger issue here, frankly, which is that we're all united as members of the human race by our common humanity and our common ability to experience the transcendent, however we define that. My father, who died an agnostic, would have defined that as standing outside looking up at the sky and just going, wow, you know, at all the stars. I mean, for every person it's different. But I just have to believe at some point in his life Jerry Falwell had that, or hoped that he did, at least. Next question. There we go. Yeah, a different mic. This mic over here. Sorry.
I'm way off topic this morning, maybe, but I read your book, What Would Jefferson Do? And I'm thinking about a democracy that's in trouble oceans away, and seeing perhaps how this country's had some involvement in creating perhaps another civil war. So I'd turn you loose on some comments about the Palestinian situation, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it's a very, very complex situation. I've spent a lot of time in Israel over the years, and in what is now referred to as Palestine, what previously was, and the Palestinian territories. Rather than taking a position, because I don't think that there is a position right now, of who's good or who's bad or who's right or who's wrong. The position that I want to strongly take in this country is the conversation that Jimmy Carter and I had on this program about 6 months ago. He's been in Israel and spent a lot of time there, as have I, and we both know that there is a strong and active dialogue going on in Israel about the situation with regard to the Israeli state and this new Palestinian state and the wall or the border or the fence or whatever, all these different issues. And what concerns me, frankly, is that in the United States, we're not having that discussion or we're not participating in that discussion, and most Americans don't understand the dimensions of it and the pieces of it. And it's not the kind of thing that I would be able to get into in a two-minute answer to a question and give anybody else, you know, service, other than to say that I'm not one of those who will immediately condemn Israel for everything that they've done. They are... they find themselves in a very difficult situation, you know, surrounded by people who literally, many of whom literally don't believe that they should exist. I mean, that they should live. On the other hand, you look at, you know, what happened with Rachel, you know, I'm forgetting her last name, Corey, yeah, and many of the peace activists, and there have been many times when I think Israel is overreached and overreached very harshly, and they're experiencing some blowback as a consequence of that. Now, that's a conversation that you can actually have in Israel, and they have on talk radio, and they have in the newspapers about how should this be handled, and they have in the Knesset about how this should be handled and what should be done and what should be the future course. And the, you know, the, all the more is the shame part of it here is that we can't even have that conversation because most Americans don't have a baseline of knowledge sufficient to have the conversation. And so it becomes either Israel good, Israel evil, Palestine good, Palestine evil. And it's just way too complex for that. We'd have to be talking about specific things that are happening. And that's one of the reasons why I tend not to throw out one-liners on the topic. And when I do talk about it, I'll try to have a guest on who's very knowledgeable about the topic and really get into it. You know, we spent a half hour with Jimmy Carter talking about it. We got a lot of calls who were later in that hour and throughout the day, for that matter, from people who thought that Jimmy Carter had gone too far and was saying the wrong things. And it was an interesting conversation. But like I said, and as you know, if you're familiar with the situation, it's not something that could be handled in a soundbite. Yes.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for being here. Thanks for doing what you do. I was one of the three people who was kicked out of the Bush event visit 2 years ago.
Oh, great. You're one of the Denver three. She's getting a standing ovation here.
Thank you so much.
Good on you.
Very familiar with it. Anyhow, we are now involved in a lawsuit against, based on a pattern of First Amendment violation. Mm-hmm. But my question to you is, since arguably we're in Iraq predominantly for access to the oil, and maybe if you believe in the military-industrial complex for some profiteering by military companies and reconstruction projects and so on, anyhow, I haven't been given a more credible reason by anyone in D.C. And the fact that the Democrats aren't doing so great in getting us out of there, despite a now strong majority of Americans wanting us out, in order to get true reform in our political system and from our leaders to represent we the people rather than corporate interests, shouldn't we collectively put all or most of our activist energy into campaign election reform?
Yes, public financing of elections, in my opinion.
I mean, it just seems like, yeah. It seems like first and foremost, our elected leaders will always be beholden to corporations in order to get elected or reelected.
No, you're absolutely right, and it's a mantra I need to be singing more often on this program. We need to be doing more shows on it. We need to get more aggressively into it because that is the solution, is public funding of elections and getting the money out of it. If you can stick around, I'd like to ask you about your experience with your lawsuit. We have to take a break. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman broadcasting live from Boulder, Colorado, the Boulder Theater, AM 760 Progressive Talk.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Chicken hearts. Chicken hearts. Chicken hearts. Chicken hearts. Chicken hearts.
Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going? Hey!
Chicken hawks. Chicken hawks. Chicken hawks. Chicken hawks. Chicken hawks.
Karl Rove, he didn't serve. Dick Cheney,
he didn't serve.
Tom DeLay,
he didn't serve.
And George Bush was AWOL.
Ah, the old Chicken Hawks song. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our number. We're broadcasting live from the Boulder Theater here in Boulder, Colorado. 760 AM 760, Progressive Talk. And apropos of the Chicken Hawk thing, John McCain, the only guy who actually served in combat at the Republican convention speaking.
The interesting thing about that aspect is that during the debate when we did the Detainee Treatment Act, there was a sharp division between those who had served in the military and those who hadn't.
And that's what it comes down to. Anyhow, we were talking. You didn't identify yourself.
Leslie Weiss.
Leslie, you are one of the three folks who was thrown out of the Bush event here a year and a half ago, thereabouts?
Just over 2 years
ago.
Two
years ago. And tell us about the lawsuit.
Well, the ACLU and a private Denver firm is representing us, and we just had some recent significant events with the lawsuit back in March. An appeals court actually ruled in unprecedented fashion and said that, against, of course, the defendant's wishes, that we were able to get some limited discovery before the deadline ran in May. In March.
Who are the defendants?
We had initially listed two local people who were physically involved in our removal, mm-hmm. but we also listed five John and Jane Does because it's our contention through the lawsuit that this was a pattern that happened across the country. It's a pattern of free speech violations, and it had happened. It wasn't just something that happened to us. We had found five or six other incidents. So our lawsuit alleges a pattern of First Amendment violations. If we didn't get the limited discovery before the deadline, our case would have just, you know, we didn't. It wasn't our goal just to list these two people, it was to go as high as we could to show where the pattern, where the policy originated, mm-hmm. which we believe, you know, is
probably Carl
as you
Rove.
Said, Carl Rove.
Yeah.
So, unprecedented. The appeals court stayed their action, pushed it back down to the district court, and said, "Yes, you can have your limited discovery." And by doing that, we found out that there were very high-level officials, one of which was the deputy director of the White House advance team, specifically directed our removal. He
wow.
was at the event. He sits closer to George Bush in the White House than even Cheney does. So we were right. And also through depositions, what else interesting we found out was, and I'm sorry, I don't have the name off the top of my head, but the person who's no longer in the government but who was also involved in our removal, also a very high-level person, specifically said during depositions, or actually, I'm sorry, it wasn't depositions, it was when media approached him afterward, that the White House did have a policy of excluding citizens based on viewpoint.
Amazing.
So
amazing. We
our
are,
contentions are have all turned out to be true so far.
Well, good on you, and good on you for standing up, and thanks for sharing your story with us, and keep it up.
Yeah, we will.
And anytime there are things happening in that case that you think are newsworthy, let David Poole, my producer, know. Let us know, and we'll put you on the radio. I'd like to keep track of this. Thanks so much for being with us. Victoria Jones is with us in Washington, D.C. She's a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. I just came from the press conference of President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair, which is always overwhelming for me being a dual citizen. I don't know which direction to look in. You know, I get very confused.
Yes.
But it was very interesting. There were a couple of things that I think will be of interest to you. President Bush was asked whether he gave the order for Gonzalez and Andrew Card to go to the room of John Ashcroft when he was lying sick and had already handed over power to James Comey and to try and get him to sign off on the warrantless wiretapping. And he dodged the question, completely dodged the question. And then he was asked again, did you give the order, sir? And he dodged the question again.
Right. So this is something that's probably not going to go away?
No, this is not going to go away.
Good.
And then on
And then I also heard, I saw a news report that he kind of lost his temper.
He lost his temper a little bit. Mostly he kept his temper most of the time. The British press were pretty obstreperous, you know. They were feisty. They were actually, you know, they did.
They were actual reporters.
Do. Yeah, they did what reporters do.
As opposed to the American press, which does what sheep do mostly.
Right.
Yeah. Yourself excluded.
Thank you very much. But
you're
of
welcome.
Course, he didn't call on me today. I didn't get a chance to ask my extremely, extremely succinct question. But nevertheless, he was asked a question about Wolfowitz. And that was interesting again because even though he did not hang him out to dry, he did not come out and defend him in any shape or form of the way that he has been doing in the last week or so.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So Gonzalez, dead man walking.
Gonzalez, dead man walking, although Gonzalez, he dodged the question. At the moment, you still got to think that Gonzalez has his support.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just wondering, you know, if Gonzalez leaves, who's going to take his place, and is that person going to actually start enforcing the law, and is that then going to lead, I mean, you know, are we viewing a repeat of the Saturday Night Massacre or what led up to it kind of scenario where, you know, somebody with some guts gets into the position of attorney general and all of a sudden the president's got a problem?
And who can get confirmed?
Well, that's, you know, somebody with some guts, presumably, somebody who will stand up.
And is that what the president wants? Does he want somebody with some guts? That's,
well, no, but he may not have a choice.
Right. One name that's been floated about is Ted Olson.
Oh, my.
I know, Ted Olson. But as being a compromise candidate.
Ted Olson is such a partisan. I mean, he's such a right-wing partisan. The former Solicitor General. You think the Democrats would go for him?
I think it's a possibility that they would, because I think he's seen as at least being honest.
Well, that's interesting. Interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria, for reporting.
Thanks very much.
Good talking with you. And greetings to you from Denver and Boulder, where we are broadcasting live from the Boulder Theater. We'll be back right after the news.
Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. We're broadcasting live today from Boulder, Colorado. AM 760 Progressive Talk hosting us. And a special thanks to all the folks here who are helping put this together. And we'll get through that list in a little bit. But right now, Marcus Mabry is with us. He's an author of a new book, Twice as Good. He's also an editor of Newsweek. But the new book, Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power, published by Rodale Press, rodalepress.com. Marcus, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Condi Rice is one of those characters that, in my mind, it seems like a very complex person. I mean, her work at Stanford University, I think, was probably commendable. Her work with George W. Bush is condemnable, much of it, in my opinion. Who is Condoleezza Rice?
Well, you know, that's why I took 2 years to try to write this book, to figure out the answer to that question. She's a person of enormous contradictions. You know, she's a little, she grew up as a little black girl in segregated Birmingham, Alabama, and then she became, by 2000, the most visible spokesperson for a political party that opposed many civil rights gains.
Many civil rights gains from which she benefited.
Absolutely, from which she benefited at every stage of her career. You know, her first job at Stanford, which she was hired for right out of the University of Denver, where she got her PhD, she was an affirmative action hire. The professor who hired her said, you know, we're hiring you because you're black and you're a woman. We don't need another specialist in Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union, but because you're black and female, we're going to give you this position. But when it comes time for tenure as a professor, basically a lifelong position, then we're not going to, you know, look at your race or gender. And she said, well, that sounds fair. So I wanted to get behind this public mask that Rice has, which is so disciplined and so defined and so usually on the lines of this administration's policies, to understand who she really was as a person, because the contradictions didn't all add up.
She seems to have no love life. She seems to have no life outside of following George Bush around. She referred to him once as her husband and then caught herself. I don't mean to, like, you know, inquire into her sexuality or something like that, but I'm just curious, how does somebody, has she totally surrendered any personal life to her career? And if so, or to whatever extent that may be the case, you know, how do you think she feels about that?
Well, you know, she is an incredibly compartmentalized person. And actually, we talked about In the book, I wanted to get at both the policy issues to explain why she made the decisions she made, why she said the things she said, and everything from the lead-up to the war in Iraq to what she's doing now in the Middle East, to understand as well her personal life, because we didn't really have a sense of it, so I wanted to understand exactly, you know, who did she date and when. And so I did that. She actually wasn't very forthcoming on the personal questions, other than to confirm or deny what I got from other reports, talking to all of her friends and her family. But she had a real social life. I mean, she's had a long dating history, dating guys who she tended to not like the sweet, kind guys, but the bold and bodacious guys who she dated. And I think, frankly, she liked bad boys. That's what her family told me. That's what her girlfriend told me. And George Bush, most of her friends and family are Democrats, and most of them are liberal Democrats. They actually said that George Bush was one of those bad boys.
So do you think that she's following Bush not out of ideology and not perhaps even out of political or power climbing, but because she's in love with him?
Well, you know, I don't think it goes that far. We actually talked about that, when you were talking about her calling him her husband. We actually talked about that. I asked her about that in one of our interviews. And she actually said, she didn't say it definitely didn't happen, but she said she's pretty positive she never made that slip at a lock-in dinner party that's been reported. And I actually talked to other guests from that party, and they too said that they didn't hear her say that. While there are other guests, this was a party of journalists at Phil Taubman, the then Washington, D.C. bureau chief of the New York Times.
But there were numerous people who reported that.
Yeah, well, they all came from the same report. They were all the same journalists telling the same other journalists what they think they heard.
I see.
So she denies that. But what it is, it's a sibling relationship, and it is an intense affinity for each other. One of Rice's friends, her best friend, another one of her contradictions, I think, given the politics of the party she represents. But her very best friend is a gay man who's been in a relationship for 28 years with his partner, and he and Rice are incredibly close. But he described her relationship with George Bush as Siamese twins attached to the frontal lobe. And so there's this weird transfer of energy, he says, where they reinforce each other. I think also when it came to the war in Iraq, it's in negative ways. But before that, when the relationship first began, she saw him as kind of a combination of Ronald Reagan, kind of clarity of moral vision, black and white, right and wrong, and what she thought would be the moderation and intelligence of Bush's father, who she'd worked for in his White House. So she thought Bush was kind of the perfect combination. That's why she was attracted to his politics.
Is she feeling betrayed now?
No, she's not, you know, because she doesn't, she's an incredible compartmentalizer. So for her, these contradictions don't bother her at all. And she really feels she's an alternate.
You realize, Mark Mabry, that's, you know, you're what you're calling compartmentalization, there's a variety of ways to describe that in psychology, and most of them are in the context of pathology.
Well, you know, I'm not gonna deny any of that, those psychological terms. Here's a great example where I think the strength of Condi Rice became, in some cases in this administration, tragic flaws. And again, I think, you know, a very positive attribute can become a very negative attribute in the context. When she was a little 7 or 8 year old girl, excuse me, 8 or 9 year old girl, living in Birmingham, her dad took her on a trip to Washington, D.C. Now, at this point, she couldn't eat a hamburger in a lunch counter at a local Woolworths because of segregation. She's a little black girl, can't even eat a hamburger at a lunch counter. She goes to Washington with her dad, stands in front of the White House for a picture he takes, which is on the back of my book. And she says to her father, one day I'll be inside this house. Now, for any little 8 or 9 year old black girl from Birmingham to say that, you say, well, this kid's delusional. That's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. But Condoleezza Rice turns out to be right. And this is an example of the kind of utter determination and discipline she has and her ability to ignore reality, external realities that she doesn't want to acknowledge. That's a positive thing in her life. It leads to accomplishment after accomplishment. We could turn now to the run-up to the war in Iraq. And she's going to ignore the external realities, which suggests that it might not be a good idea to go to Iraq and to depose Saddam Hussein. And secondly, the external realities that suggest we're going to need a lot more troops than Don Rumsfeld wants us to believe. It was her job as National Security Advisor to protect the president from making dumb mistakes. As Brent Scowcroft said, who's one of Rice's mentors, the ultimate job of the National Security Advisor is to be the skeptic-in-chief. Condi Rice was not the skeptic-in-chief. She saw her job as enabling, as giving shape to George Bush's values, rather than confronting.
I spoke with Sandy Berger about 2 years ago, and not off the record but not recorded conversation. I mean, this was an in-person conversation, not part of this radio program. And he said that he told Condi Rice, and I'm sure he said this many times in other venues, that he told Condi Rice as he was leaving as National Security Advisor and she was coming in as National Security Advisor in January of 2001, that her number one job was going to be stopping Osama bin Laden because he was going to come and hurt us. That the Clinton administration had tried to assassinate him unsuccessfully three times. They had stopped some efforts of his. They knew something was up, and this should be her number one priority. We now know that there were some 56 different specific warnings from a variety of sources, different governments, as well as within the United States. All of this stuff should have been going into Condi Rice's office. Richard Clark talks about running around with his hair on fire. Why didn't Condi Rice, if she was the National Security Advisor, play the role that Sandy Berger did of trying to bring together the national security apparatus to prevent 9/11, A, and B, how has that incredible failure of hers been virtually completely ignored by the media?
Well, you know, there are a few things there.
And we only have a minute before we've got to wrap this up.
So. I'll try to sum that up real quick. I go into the reasons of why she failed to get the clues, of why she also didn't connect with Richard Clark. I talked to 9/11 Commissioner Saffer, who tells me why he thinks the commission report soft-pedaled her responsibility. I've got Phil Delico, who used to work with her, actually saying that it was her job to make sure the CIA and FBI were talking to each other. So all that stuff's in there, and I lay it out in detail. And I also explain what it was in her own history, personal and professional, that made her unlikely to see this. But the biggest problem, I thought, was the fact that this administration came in hell-bent on ignoring everything the Clintonians told them. Anything but Clinton was their motto, and Rice was a part of that. I think the reason she's gotten off historically from that so far is that she was not alone in not getting the hints. I mean, it was actually a government-wide problem.
Yeah, well, Al Gore told Dick Cheney this, Bill Clinton told George Bush this, Sandy Berger told Condi Rice this, and all three of them chose to ignore it.
That's right. But, you know, and then both administrations, you know, come up for upgrading the 9/11 Commission report. What commissioners told me is that the Bush administration didn't get a harder whooping in the report because of the politics of it.
Right. Nobody's blameless, but interesting. Marcus Mabry, the book Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power. Thanks, Marcus, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you live from Boulder, Colorado.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Boulder, Colorado. Put on by AM 760, Progressive Talk. We're having a great time here at the Boulder Theater. Packed to the gills and just a fine time. Is Colorado Clean Campaigns, Dan Gould, are you, Dan, can
hi
you?
There.
Hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Great. We were talking during the break, and I'd like you to just in very short form tell us what you're up to.
Sure. Publicly financed campaigns is a movement nationwide. Several states have adopted publicly financed campaigns, most notably in Maine and Arizona, that are the best and the brightest at the present time. Okay. And CleanCampaignsColorado.com is the website of an organization that's working on having a ballot initiative in 2008. 2009 or 2010, depending upon how long it takes to build the support, to get publicly financed campaigns for state-level offices, for state legislature, for the state senate, and so forth.
Right. Yeah. That's great. Good on you. And the website is cleancampaignscolorado.com.
That's exactly right.
Clean Campaigns Colorado. And for those people who are listening in other states and are thinking about doing something like this. Now, there's only 20 or 21 states that have initiative processes that can do it like you're doing it here.
Yes.
But basically, what's the process that you went through or that you're going through?
The process we're going through, right now we're in the process of actually writing the bill that we would present to the people to vote on.
Are you borrowing heavily from that of Maine or Arizona? Or are you...
Actually, there's a national organization called Public Financing that is, Public Campaigns rather, that has a model law that we're using and adapting to Colorado's particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
It is built on Maine's experience, Arizona's experience, New Jersey's experience, Maryland's experience, and so forth. There are several places in the nation where this is happening.
Right.
And the model bill can be adapted to the particular circumstances of the state, and we're working on doing that for Colorado right now.
Great. Dan, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. CleanCampaignsColorado.com. Check it out. 1-866-303-2270. Chris in Camp Pendleton, California. Hey, Chris, you're an Army sergeant?
Marine Corps.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I have a comment on... I'm actually from Denver, so hello to everyone out there. I have a comment on Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah.
She actually perjured herself before the 9/11 Commission. They asked her what... She said that there was no actual evidence at all in the August 6th PDB, which, of course, there was. It stated explicitly how they were going to hit us, where they were going to hit us, and the when really doesn't matter because it's in the future. So you do your job as National Security Advisor to stop it no matter what. She said she didn't even know that that was part of her job when explicitly in the title it is the job.
Right.
Then they asked her, what did you do about it? And she said, well, I warned the FAA. Well, why would she do anything about it if she just testified 2 minutes before Bob Kerry asked her that question? She said there was no actual evidence, but I warned the FAA, so there was. So she perjured herself. And what did she get for that? A pat on the back and a promotion to Secretary of State. And it just shows the hypocrisy. It is so sickening. Now that we have a Democratic Congress, of course, apparently they're too busy to go back and nail her for perjuring herself. Hopefully.
Well, there's so many. It's like, you know, it's like walking into the kitchen at night and turning the light on, and there's 1,000 cockroaches. You know, where do you start stomping? But, Chris, you make a good point, and thank you very much for making it. I appreciate it. Well said. Laurel in Fort Lewis, Washington. Hey, Laurel, you had some information on Ted Olson.
Well, it's just that I'm glad. Let's hear it for old-timers and our long memories, because I remember that the result of Nixon's Saturday night massacre was Judge Bork.
Right.
And they eventually settled upon him because of his willingness to see the president as he who could do no crime.
That's right.
It cost him a Supreme Court nomination, and I would wish the same for Ted Olson, because he's a political animal over being an officer of the court. He came from the vice president's office as his chief counsel. Under that time, when they had their heads together, they expanded executive privilege to include the office of the vice president for the first time in history.
Right, this is Cheney's office.
And they got secret meetings with captains of industry that influenced policy, and they didn't have to reveal them.
That's right. And it went to the Supreme Court, the energy policy meetings.
Yeah. And also,
you know, I think he gets cut a lot of slack because his wife died in 9/11. That seems to be...
Having written a book about that slammed Hillary Clinton, and he took personal interest and energy after her death to edit, re-edit, and finally publish that screed, which to me defines him as a political animal.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And Ted Olson, I would be horrified if Ted Olson was there as Attorney General. Well said. Judy in Portland, Oregon. Judy, a little less than a minute here. You said you know some folks who've been visited by federal agents?
Yes. The reason that prompted me to call, long-time listener, first-time caller, Tom.
Thanks
for all you do. Reason I called today is because the woman who spoke on the mic at the end of the first hour just rang a bell with me. I have a very close friend who actually put on an electronic voting forum in Portland and has been very much involved in the issue, and she shared with me about a month ago the very same story. And I do think that those who say we have nothing to fear, if you've done nothing wrong, don't worry about the NSA spying on you, need to remember that a government that amasses power to itself in the name of protecting us from an outside enemy, such as communism in the day when I was young and terrorism today, will succumb to the temptation to use that to suppress dissent. I'd like to get in touch with that woman if she'd come up to you afterwards and leave her information. I've given my information to your call screener.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy. Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program broadcasting live from Boulder, Colorado, in the Boulder Theater.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. Broadcasting live from Boulder, Colorado at the Boulder Theater. Tomorrow we'll be in Santa Fe, KTRC, also. Just a heads up. And Saturday doing a book signing at the Greer Garson Theater. And with us right now on the program, we have Eric Bollert, who is the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, worked for 5 years as a senior writer for Salon.com, where he wrote extensively about media and politics. And this is our Best of the Rest of the News segment, by the way. And Mark Carlin, who's the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com, two really great news sources. And first of all, to both of you, just a breaking news I'm seeing here. Senate Democrats, this is from the Associated Press, plan to seek a no-confidence vote on Alberto Gonzalez over accusations that he carried out President Bush's political agenda at the expense of the Justice Department's independence. Chuck Schumer and Dianne Feinstein saying that they're going to call for this thing. Any thoughts or, you know, what's your take on this, Eric Bollert?
Well, it's nice to be in the majority. Then you can schedule votes like that. I mean, it really shows what the difference between the minority and majority is. And, you know, if the Bush White House isn't going to do anything about Gonzalez, Democrats, I think, are going to try to do everything in their power to show him the way out.
Right. And I should add, by the way, Eric, you're here representing MediaMatters.com.
That's right.
And Media Matters, or it's MediaMatters.org, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. MediaMatters.org, and, you know, just one of the great websites out there keeping track of what's going on in the media. We were talking, Eric, a little earlier with a fellow, Marcus Mabry, who wrote a Newsweek editor and has written a new book called Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power. He's talking about Condi Rice and, you know, painting a fairly complex picture of her. And I asked the question, why did she get a pass on 9/11 happening? And really, there's even a larger question. Why did the entire Bush administration, you know, Cheney, Rice, and Bush, all three of them were told when they came into office by their predecessors that 9/11 was on its way? They had all these specific warnings. Why is it to this day here, now 6 years later, the American people are still not holding them accountable?
The Bush administration and Condi Rice?
Right.
You know, I think Condi got a pass because she was sort of seen as a darling of the press. I think she worked the press very well. I think she was an effective source for them during the war years and right after 9/11. And I think right after 9/11, the press wasn't that interested in asking, you know, the very difficult questions of why were we so vulnerable and what did the administration do during the summer of 2001. And after a while, I think the press just decided, you know, sort of we don't want to go there anymore. And even after with the 9/11 commission, I think you're right that the administration really, in a public forum, never really had to answer the really tough questions about what went wrong.
Yeah, indeed. Mark Carlin with BuzzFlash.com. Mark, your headline, Married to the Mob, the story of Alberto G. Tell us about your BuzzFlash editorial here.
The story of the week, and I'm glad to hear that the Senate is going to seek a British-style no-confidence vote in Gonzalez, is the high noon moment that occurred, according to James B. Comey, who was acting attorney general at the time at a George Washington University hospital. This, of course, was something out of a movie script where you had John Ashcroft lying in bed under medication, post-operative, and we were going to have Alberto Gonzalez and then Chief of White House Staff Andrew Card show up to try to force him to sign backing of illegal wiretapping, domestic wiretapping, that is, to be permitted by Bush. And John Ashcroft plays the unlikely role of Gary Cooper in this high noon movie role.
Yeah, we were commenting on that a little earlier here. One of the folks in the audience here in Boulder was, wait a minute, John Ashcroft is the good guy in this?
Well, and you had John Comey, who was then the acting attorney general. Ashcroft was felt he was so incapacitated that he had appointed Comey the acting attorney general, and then you have two kind of bit actors from The Godfather show up, meaning Gonzalez and Card, to try to take advantage of this guy who is barely conscious, according to Comey, to get him to sign permission for Bush to illegally wiretap, even though Ashcroft, before he went into the operation, had taken a firm position. And this is Mr. Executioner and supporter of torture, John Ashcroft, that this bill was illegal. It's an extraordinary moment. In fact, what's even more extraordinary for those people in the audience and listeners who read the story in the New York Times and some other papers is that Comey, again, remember, this is the acting attorney general of the United States, called the head of the FBI, Mr. Mueller, to come to the hospital room to make sure that Gonzalez and Card would not kick Comey out of the room, and kind of forced Ashcroft to sign this permission for illegal wiretapping while he was under the influence of medication.
Right. He's sitting there with a morphine drip, and they're going, hey, we got a plan for you.
an absolutely unprecedented, at least as far as we know, act that the Washington Post, whose editorial board has generally been supportive of the administration, despite their reputation as a liberal newspaper, to call this, and I'm quoting from the Washington Post editorial, an account of Bush administration lawlessness so shocking it would have been unbelievable coming from a less reliable source than James B. Comey.
Yeah, it's really quite extraordinary. And ultimately it leads right to George W. Bush. I mean, here you have Ashcroft, I believe, is an attorney, right? He was a lawyer.
Yes.
And Comey was a lawyer. And as I recall, you've got a number of people who understand the law. Andy Card, I don't think, is a lawyer. Gonzalez is a lawyer, but, you know, we're not sure that he ever really understood the law. And George W. Bush is not an attorney. He's never studied the law. He studied, you know, history, and he got a degree, a master's in business administration. And so it seems that the legal policy of the United States in violation of the law is being made by George W. Bush and is being executed by these two guys, arguably only one of them a lawyer, over the objection of people in the administration who actually understand the law. Is that a reasonable summary?
That is not only a reasonable summary, that's highly accurate. In the 800-pound grill in the room that the press, and Eric's an expert on this, doesn't seem to acknowledge in cases like this, as with Valerie Plame, as with the lies in Iraq, Bush is at the center of this. Mr. Comey, the former acting attorney general, testified that he thought it was Bush himself who called the FBI agents who were guarding Ashcroft at George Washington University Hospital to allow Mr. Card and Mr. Gonzalez, who was then the personal counsel in the White House to Bush, to come into the bedroom, because Ashcroft's wife had given orders that no one was to be let in, that he was, Mr. Ashcroft was too sick and he was not to be disturbed. And Mr. Comey said that it was Bush himself, he believes, who picked up the phone to make the way for Card and Gonzalez to go into the room to try to browbeat Ashcroft into signing this illegal order.
Right. Which takes us back to Eric. It's Bollert, not Baylor, right?
Yeah.
I'm pronouncing
that's right.
Yeah, that's what I thought. With MediaMatters.com, you're an astute observer of the press. This seems, if nothing else, I mean, the impeachable offense, I've been saying for a couple of years now, that Bush has admitted to is violating the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA law. This was basically the godfather ordering this illegal operation to happen through his consigliere, through Gonzalez, Ashcroft fighting back against it, ultimately Comey giving in after a private meeting with Bush. I mean, where is the press in all this? If Richard Nixon had been doing this, they would have been all over him.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, as Mark mentioned, I mean, if you contrast the elephant in the room and Bush, I mean, Bush is a central player in the story, and yet, you know, if you read the press accounts and you listen to the pundit chatter, he doesn't really appear as a player.
They're all talking about Gonzalez.
And what if, and compare that to Clinton. I mean, when Clinton was in office, the press portrayed him as this mob boss who had his hand in everything, every possible scenario that came up. Everything automatically went right back to the Oval Office. And what did Bill and Hillary know, and when did they know?
Right, with the Christmas card, card list, and the
right.
and what travel agent was being fired. And
now we have the opposite, whereas Bush is central in every failure and every controversial move, and yet no one ever really. I mean, is it the low expectations game again? I don't know. Does the press sort of come to the conclusion that Bush isn't really the president anymore? I mean, does he have so little power and prestige left that they don't think it's worth asking these questions?
Is it that the press is occupied, at the highest level, the press is filled with people who have 6- and 7-figure salaries who don't want to risk it by angering George Bush?
I don't know if it's that direct, but there's certainly an interesting phenomena as the Bush demise unfolds before our eyes in these last 2 years, that the press doesn't really seem interested in that story or even want to document this sort of monumental collapse. And they sort of look away, and it's about Gonzalez and the war is about the generals, and everything is sort of not about Bush as he sort of falls off
the story of his life. Although we should give a tip of the hat to Kelly Arena at CNN, who actually asked him about it today. Eric Bollard of MediaMatters.com, Mark Carlin, editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com, two great websites. Gentlemen, both, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour, live from Boulder, Colorado. Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. Broadcasting live from Boulder, Colorado, the Boulder Theater, AM 760 Progressive Talk. Special thanks to Chris Olinger and Kenny Danan and the Wizard, our engineer here. Chris running the station. Daryl Luby, Jan Whitbeck, Amy Montano, Jenny Godin, Anthony Brown, Tyler Holden, the entire crew at the Boulder Theater, and the Tattered Cover Bookstore, sponsor of AM 760 Progressive Talk, and also here selling books. Pleased to have you with us. Let's take a couple of questions from the audience here. Go ahead.
Hi, Tom. You mentioned a couple of segments ago about people working for their party, and I'm pretty much of an activist, and I often help with the Democrats. But this is my question. How do you help people recognize that they're voting against their own best interests when they're Republicans and they want to beat you up because of what you're trying to talk about liberally?
For example?
Well, just whenever with the last election, I tried to show how all of the different candidates, what their ideas were and how they were voting. And I said, don't you like to vote for people who think the same way you do?
Yeah.
But they often don't. They just vote their party line instead of voting for their own best interests.
It's a tough one, and it's interesting. There's been some really fascinating brain science done recently where they're actually imaging the brain when they expose people to information. A lot of it actually came out of marketing and psychology. And there was a study published a couple of years ago that showed that when you exposed Democrats to information that reflected badly on the Democrats, or when you exposed Republicans to information that reflected badly on Republicans, that was accurate in either case, it went to a different part of the brain, different part of the brain lit up, than when you exposed Democrats to information that was favorable to the Democratic Party, or Republicans to information that was favorable, then a more affinity type. Basically, there's the first response is an emotional response, and the second response is the intellectual response to information. So what this tells us is that people who are really and truly you know, in their heart of hearts, you know, believe a particular worldview, it's going to be very, very difficult to change their minds. And so those people who watch Fox News in order to get a reinforcement of their worldview, who listen to right-wing talk radio in order to get a reinforcement of their worldview, you're not going to change their minds with facts, by and large. I mean, we can try, and those, you know, we live with people like that, we know people like that, we work with people like that, and you know, you always fight the good battle. I think, though, that what you will find is that that percentage of people who are really, truly, deeply convinced, hold a strong conviction, an emotional level conviction, is probably fairly small on both sides. On our side, it's probably 15-20%, and on the Republican side, it's probably 15 or 20%. And so, as much as it's a kind of a James Carville cliche that you need to work on the middle, that's really what we need to do, is find those people who are still, their mind is still open. In most cases, because they haven't been paying attention. You know, they've been watching, yeah, you know, the game on TV kind of thing, or they've been working so hard they haven't had a chance to pay attention. And we need to be reaching out to those people who are not yet convinced. I have the, one of the reasons that I have debates with people on this radio program all the time, knowing that I'm not going to change their minds because they're in that place, you know, and they have an investment in that place, is that those people in the middle who might be listening to the program then have an opportunity to hear both sides of the debate and make a rational decision. I think that that's how we reach that kind of rational middle. I call this program Uncommon Sense in the Radical Middle, and I think that we are the middle, but still, there are a lot of people out there who just aren't political, and they need, they're the ones we need to reach. I would keep talking to my neighbor or my friend or my brother-in-law or whatever that, you know, who is a conservative and a Republican, but don't hold high hope for us.
Okay,
you know.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah, sir.
Tom, you are a master, and I thank you very much for coming here to Boulder, Colorado. You are a great teacher for the progressive movement in America, and I value everything that you say. You hit the nail on the head so many times, it's just really wonderful to watch. And I'd like to get your idea of what is the best way we can do to eliminate the corporatist control of our government?
Well, I think the discussion we've had before, the two issues, number one, getting corporate money out of politics. In 1907, Teddy Roosevelt signed into law a law that made it a felony for a corporation to give money to political parties and political activities. It has been watered down 1,000 times since then, although it's still on the books. We need to be looking at something like that. Mm-hmm. And part of that means repealing corporate personhood, because the Supreme Court, as long as they take the position that corporations are persons, then of course they have First Amendment rights of free speech, and that's a problem. But the larger one, I think, is the public funding of elections. It's something Bernie Sanders always comes back to. It's something that, you know, your compatriot, your fellow Coloradan was, if I'm
Daniel.
Saying that right. Yeah, what Daniel was talking about. That's a big issue. Yes, sir.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for coming. I really have appreciated it. It's been special. My concern ties back into what Victoria Jones said about the Democrats in Congress maybe rolling over for Ted Olson. Mm. The Democrats in Congress don't seem to have the courage to do the pushing back against the Bush administration.
And that's why we have to give them the courage.
I mean, exactly.
If the parade is big enough, if the parade is loud enough, if the parade is strong enough, they will get out in front of it and say, this is my parade.
And I would ask you to be our leader on that parade. Keep the pressure on those guys.
Yeah, well, we're all in it together. I mean, I can call my senators and I can call my member of Congress every single day, but you have to be doing it, and you have to do it, and you have to do it, and each one of all of us have to be doing it. It has to be. It's a collaborative effort. That's democracy.
Thank you. You
know, yeah, thanks for your kind words. And thanks so much, all of you, for being here today. It's just great to see a theater full of people, and an honor to be here and share this time with you. And thanks to our listeners. We'll be back tomorrow with Brunch with Bernie, and our Anything Goes Day. We'll be broadcasting tomorrow from Santa Fe. See you then. Oh, and don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.